This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Jesse Walpe on August 23rd, 2013. And Jesse, thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you for having me. You pronounced my name perfectly.
Yes. Jesse, could you talk to us a bit about what inspired you to want to be an artist?
Sure. I think my dad had a lot to do with it. He was an artist himself. He never got paid for it, but he was a really talented illustrator and drawer and sculptor. And, you know, when we were young, he was always working on little projects. And, you know, my parents always took us to art museums when we were younger. Although I never had art in, you know, middle school or high school, which I feel like I really kind of missed out on, knowing that it was a, you know, legitimate career choice, or knowing that I was creative and I could make things. I think that happened more like in home life.
Talk to us a little bit about your art.
Sure.
And for example, like, why do you create what you create?
Perfect. I can start with the why. Well, I think that goes back probably even before me, you know, to my parents and what kind of people they were, which led me into me and what kind of person I am. And that kind of leads me into what I make, I believe. And I won't be too long, but, you know, my parents were really independent kind of people. They liked doing a lot of things on their own. They built all the houses we ever lived in. They were always building. And they always wanted these houses to be in the middle of the woods. And I appreciate that. I don't know their exact decision. They just kind of wanted to be a little bit away from society and living on their own with their kids. So our first house was in Plum Bottom, New York. It was just a little teeny shack in the middle of the woods, and we lived there for a couple of years. Our second house was really close by, close to Wellsville, where I was born. And it was on top of a hill, Alma Hill. And it was just a beautiful setting. We had ferns surrounding the house under the tree canopy. And my parents would call us in for supper, and, you know, my brother and I would hide below the ferns. It was just a nice memory of the place. It was something my parents did was pick a lot of wild plants, and we had a lot of wild plants when we were younger. You know, dandelions and lamb's quarters and poke and all kinds of berries, elderberries and blueberries and huckleberries and raspberries. And my dad made wine out of these things, and we ate these, and probably even ate some groundhog here and there. But it was, you know, it was a really kind of unique experience. Even my first job was picking huckleberries for my parents with a little can tied around my waist.
Did you get a good price for it?
It was fairly reasonable for the time. You're talking 1980, 84, 85, and 50 cents for a cup. So it, actually not a reasonable price. But it was just a great experience growing up. Even when I was four and my brother was five, we moved down to Mississippi. And my parents built us a house in the woods, and another beautiful setting, but a totally different place. It was an exploration. We found all kinds of new plants and animals and red wasps and fire ants. And while my parents were building our house, my brother and I would just, you know, play in the woods. We'd build little huts and shelters and tree houses and lofts. And we had all kinds of building materials around us. We had pine straw, which is a great covering material. We had a woods of young pine trees. We had this method where we would climb up these young pine trees and just ride them down as they broke. But they would be perfectly straight and thin, and we could use those for building teepees and, you know, all kinds of different things. So it was a lot of building things when I was younger, and, you know, it totally makes sense now. So, you know, I think that was just a great experience. I'm kind of lucky to grow up in that way, kind of immersed in nature, among the plants and the animals. But you know, kind of fast forwarding a little bit, get into my work a little bit. In graduate school, my third piece that I made, after kind of just learning methods, joinery methods, learning about, you know, wood characteristics and things like that, and, you know, making kind of some typical pieces, the first three or four, and then I think it was my third or fourth piece, I realized I could do something else. When I got to graduate school, I came back to Rochester, New York. And once again, you know, a change in locale, a change in geography. And I was finding little inspiration everywhere, especially with the changing seasons, all these little buds and little berries and seed pods. And I was photographing all of these things. You know, maybe looking for inspiration everywhere, but definitely finding it everywhere. And like I said, in my, you know, fourth piece, I kind of tried to take some of these little things that I saw and see if I could make my artwork from some of those references. So after making that piece, and it was like kind of a big voluminous form, and it had an outstretched, long, curvy stem to it, and a kind of a curved leaf, and it looked like a little sprout. And it was really upon finishing that I thought to myself, wow, I can make things that aren't just objects, but I can make little things with, you know, little teeny lives inside of them. And it was just so much more interesting to make things that, you know, seem to be alive. So after I started doing that, I didn't really stop. I've taken a couple breaks to make some different bodies of work, but I've pretty much, you know, continued with this thing that I'm making, this language that I'm speaking, for, you know, probably about 8 years now. Mm-hmm. Kind of still not quite on to the next body of work yet, because I haven't completed what I'm doing here. And those pieces, they come out being little berries and fruits and plump looking things with like really significant connection points. Like a vegetable would be stuck onto a stem. You know, there's kind of like a reason that's stuck onto that, and it makes sense, because that's how it developed. You know, so when I'm making these, you know, abstract organic sculptures and functional sculptures that I make, you know, I'm kind of thinking about the internal energies, and, you know, how they would develop something, how they would make something. And in the last probably 3 years or so, I've started to work in not only botanical but sort of animal characteristics. I've been dabbling with fat rolls and skin folds and stretchy skin and bellies and things like that, because mind you, not much of this is a conscious decision. You know, it's just kind of something that happens over time. But, you know, I realized that life in those plants is, you know, basically just a life in an animal. It's all living things. And there's definitely blurred lines between some of those. So I don't differentiate that anymore. Even now, things are getting even more anthropomorphic, if you will. These little, these new couple pieces I'm working on are really like amorphous forms, where they like between a newborn tadpole fetus, but also maybe like a bean pod too. Mm-hmm. Oh, and that something I wanted to mention, kind of, I like this ambiguity where it's not something you've really seen before, but it's a recognizable enough reference to multiple things, like maybe just a plant characteristic that, you know, 10 people can be absolutely sure of what this thing is in front of them, but it's different from all 10 are totally different. And another thing I've realized kind of lately is that I can tap into what we appreciate about living things. And it's some of it's coming from my thoughts when I was younger and that I still have now, like my deep appreciation of these little parts. So anyway, another thing that I'm trying to tap into, like I said, besides my own thoughts when I was younger, is to think about us as human beings going back thousands of years, and we were always really attracted to these things that we sustained our lives with, you know, and it was nuts and seeds and fruits and berries, and you look at that and you think that's a continuation of life, you know, that's all really purposeful, you know, we eat the fruits and poop out the seeds and the plant grows someplace else. I mean, it like proliferates itself. And, you know, I think I'm in a way I'm trying to reach people at that primal level where saying that, you know, we are still attracted to these things. And, you know, if I can achieve that, then it's so.
Jesse, can you talk to... So you mentioned that you've been out of school for 8 years now. But yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit about your experiences pursuing fine arts degrees and where you went and some of your thoughts on the programs and the structure of BFA and MFA programs?
Sure. Well, actually, my undergraduate, although, you know, being in engineering, being in the wrong thing for a little while... makes you kind of explore and try to find what the right thing is.
So you didn't do a BFA?
Oh, no. And then, you know, finally when I was in college and I knew what I didn't want to do, then I started looking to, you know, what I wanted to do. And I came across interior design. And it seemed like it was like a growing thing in the world. There was a lot of shows on and stuff, but it just seemed like a real creative outlet, a way I could be creative and maybe actually make money and have a job. Maybe I was thinking realistic back then. From that, I think I realized towards the end of that undergrad that, you know, this is enjoyable, but it's not as great as you think. It's still sitting behind a desk on a computer all day, so it was not something I was interested in, you know, pursuing professionally. But from that, I really got interested in furniture design. Actually, the one point I can pinpoint something, we had a lamp competition in undergrad, and it was not only to design, which, you know, was basic, but you built it. So when I did this, I can remember sanding plexiglass for, you know, hours late into the night and making this lamp out of wood and metal and plexiglass and wiring, and it was great. I realized right then that I love making things. It's fun to design, but it's so much more fun to turn these into real things. You know, what's an idea if you're not going to follow through with it? So that was a real point where I realized I think I like making things, and that led me to graduate school. I mean, I didn't have the clearest idea of what I wanted to do in life, but I just started narrowing my focus a bit. So I went to graduate school at RIT. They had a program which was woodworking and furniture design. And it was also up here. And like I said, I was born in Wellsville, Western New York. My dad grew up in Wilson. So, you know, I've got this, you know, connection to Western New York. We'd come up to Wilson and Lockport, you know, every other summer on vacation. So I, you know, I came back. Like I said, it had some influence as to where. But I went to RIT, and that's what got me into wood again. You know, and I, like I said, I didn't really realize that it didn't click in my head for a couple of years. Like, well, I've been working with wood my whole life, you know. But so that was that graduate school. That was an interesting experience. Like I said, I made a couple furniture pieces, and then right in the end of the first year, things were starting to get really sculptural. I learned the techniques, and I wasn't interested in making something that's been made. I was like, what can I do with this? It was more material explorations, like what I can do crazy things with these. I can make this very long and bend it and stretch it and make it look like it's stretched. So, you know, everything started, like I said, getting really sculptural at that point, kind of, you know, mostly functional. But I think that led me into, you know, sculpture mainly, and I ended up getting my my MFA in sculpture there with a minor in woodworking and furniture design. So it was a hell of a difficult experience, but I would do it again. I met my lovely wife there at school, so that made it worth it. Mm-hmm. And I worked my butt off.
So. Do you feel that going through the MFA experience gave you something that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is a demanding thing to make that body of work and, you know, just to be able to convey your ideas to others and have not only, you know, visually, like with the work, you know, but verbally as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very demanding experience, and it's one that asks so much of you. It asks you to make goals, lofty goals. I mean, maybe you can get by with less than lofty, but I don't see any reason why. And then, you know, go through with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was, and within, there were some influences there too. Within RIT, we were lucky enough to have Wendell Castle as an artist in residence. Mm-hmm. And that was phenomenal. We would go to his shop a couple times a semester, and he would just be very candid with everything. He would show us, talk to us about his design process. He would show us these huge drawings on the wall in his beautiful studio. And he would show us his building process, how he makes work, how he photographs work. He would talk to us about pricing work and how to, you know, think of the perfect number of pieces in a set to, you know, be the most lucrative. And he's just a super impressive guy, on the top of his game. I think he's probably 75 years old right now, and he's the man. He's so influential, and I'm sure, like, I don't even think about this consciously, but I'm sure his work, you know, I know it inspires the hell out of me. I mean, it's really, it's his own way of doing things. He's known as like the sculptor who makes furniture. And a lot of his furniture is just so unique. It doesn't, it's nothing classical, you know, it's whatever he wants. It's things with arms and legs and just really interesting forms. I think I started to really enjoy form looking at his work. Mm-hmm. And colors and finishes and textures. Even other materials, you know, he cast some things in fiberglass, and that was just beautiful. He could make them look like cars, Corvettes. And another lucky thing around that same time was Martin Perrier. He, amazing sculptor. I, you know, found out about him in graduate school. Woodworker, real craftsman. He did the best job at everything he did. He was even one of the you know, artists who went to Art Park to make installations in the past. Great sculptor. So he had a retrospective at the MoMA in 2007. And I've seen some of his, you know, photographs of his work in books and online before then. But when I got there, oh my God, I was completely just blown away. 47 pieces. And like I said, I saw it in pictures before, but everything was 10 times bigger than you thought it was. It just, like a wagon that goes 65 feet up into the air, and a ladder for Booker T. Washington, and just, so some things had, you know, particular references, like from objects, but other things were just forms, just beautiful. He's got this one, it's a beautiful sphere with other spheres kind of stuck onto it. Round, like donut-shaped things. Everything was kind of ambiguous too, but a huge influence as far as form is concerned. Like I said, all of his stuff, his woodwork, he does tar and some other things, but it's all like a pretty raw finish too. And it just shows the beauty of the wood, and it's so warm too, and inviting. Yeah, huge influence, those two.
I think it's interesting too that some of his, like, in addition to the furniture work, he also has this incredible way of creating trompe l'oeil woodwork sculptures.
Yeah.
And I can see some similarities between that way in which he is trying to recreate something natural,
mm-hmm.
and sort of in your work where you are in a very different way, but you are recreating something natural.
Yeah.
Not so much trompe l'oeil, but also very inspired by...
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, I never thought of it like that, yeah. But, it, you know, it kind of makes sense. You really, you have to think about the thing and what it wants to be,
mm-hmm.
And what it should be, yeah. And I don't know. I guess you kind of have to be pretty true to it,
yeah.
to make it believable,
mm-hmm.
to those who encounter it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say about the totality of your body of work, or some different themes that have emerged?
Yeah, sure. Well, like I said, I've, you know, kind of been working on a series for about the last 8 years now, but you know, within that. You know, I took some breaks during my MFA in sculpture. I created a pieces and installations. Just spoke a total different thing, and it was really an explorative time. You know, I was working with a lot of wood, but metal and concrete and found objects and foam and paint, and I was trying to do something different, and I learned a lot from that. And then, after graduate school, I took a residency. Actually, my wife and I both had dual residencies in West Palm Beach, Florida, at an art center. It's called the Armory. It's a great place, and we had a bronze casting facility there. And I had the opportunity to work with bronze, and I could not pass that up. And I created a whole different body of work that was, you know, much more functional, much more full of imagery and symbols, and, you know, maybe more descriptive, you know, a little less abstract. And I learned a lot from that. But, you know, at the same time, I never really stopped making this wooden organic sculpture that I've been making for a while now. I could touch on the creative process a little bit.
Please.
Let's see, and there's not always, you know, one straight path. You know, you always... None of these questions, is there one great answer? But it kind of, the creative process, a lot of times it starts with maybe one thing that I see in real life. Maybe one characteristic of a little something that I come across, or maybe maybe it's a texture, maybe it's a surface, maybe it's just like a little lip of a bud of a plant of a Rose of Sharon or something, and just that one little thing allows me to think, what can I do with that? So sometimes it starts that way. Other times it's just starts with a sketching process where I am drawing just beautiful curves and seeing what they become, and you know, bringing in little plant references. Other times when I'm drawing, I immediately start to think about those like internal energies and seeing what can come out of those. And so a lot of sketching at first, and then once I come up with pretty much what I want to do, with wood, it's you got to really plan things out ahead of time. Somebody wanted me to donate a part of a piece one time for a little something, and they said, "Oh yeah, if something you know doesn't work out, just cut it off and sand it up." And I was like, you know, I really don't have those things. You know, I have to plan things out, and I have to do what I said I was going to do, because otherwise it just won't work. So it's after I do those sketches, and you know, I do some shading, and I see what the form is going to look like, I'll do a full-scale drawing, which is very important. A lot of times in the middle there, I'll pull out some clay to actually create the form before I have to carve it out of wood, because like I said, you can't really go back. Things just get smaller and smaller and smaller. So a lot of times clay is an important medium that I use to decide on the form and what exactly it's going to look like. From there, I usually go into a full-scale drawing because I absolutely need to see what it's going to look like, to see how much wood I need to use for it. And it's not always a pretty process. It's usually not until like the very end, because it looks like big, chunky Lego blocks when I glue things together. You know, it's additive like that. And then I take my full-scale drawings, put them on the block, if you will, or the part. And I trace them along the part and maybe remove from a profile, then remove from another profile. It's like I have to be efficient as well. Mm-hmm. So I can't whittle things down. You know, you gotta think, like, what's the smartest way to do this? Otherwise, it would be a real waste of wood, a real waste of time, and it just wouldn't be the best way. So, yeah, it just goes from a blocky Lego block-looking thing, and it slowly gets a little bit more form, a little better at carving off. You always remove like the flat spots and the points. Mm-hmm. And once all of the flat spots and all the points are gone, you know, you have, you know, like an organic form. And I'm looking, there's a Rodin that said sculpture is silhouette, silhouette, silhouette. You know, I think that as well. I want there to be beautiful curves any way you look at the piece. You know, front, back, side, up and down, maybe. Maybe I need to look at it in the mirror to get like just a new kind of brain perspective on it. So that's kind of how it works, and you know, then the whole process is just tedious and time-consuming, and you just have to not lie to yourself. You have got to, and I try to convey this to my art students sometimes. You have to want to see an imperfection. You gotta want to see it. You gotta look for it, not pass it over in your mind. But you gotta look for it. And then, when you absolutely cannot find any more, when you're wanting to see it, then it you know should be perfect. So there's a level which I try to achieve that takes my hand off of the piece and makes it where it's not about me anymore at all. It's just about the thing, you know. It's completed. It's done.
Mm-hmm. You did mention that you teach as well.
Yeah, I do. I teach foundation art courses. I teach at Villa Maria College, and that's great. I love those foundation courses because, I know, in some instances, I'm the first person in these students' lives to tell them, first of all, that art is a legitimate career. And I mean, you know, I try to be an example of that. And I try to say, hey, you can do this, you know, professionally. You just have to do everything really well. And I also teach furniture design and interior design, furniture design and woodworking, which is, you know, a lot of times in a college, furniture design would be really conceptual and maybe, you know, using AutoCAD on a computer, maybe SketchUp and drawings, but a lot of times it doesn't turn into real things. Where what's unique about my class is we get to make the things, and that is just so much fun. I love showing people how to make things. Those people feel so useful after that, because they are useful, you know, they just didn't realize they had that potential inside.
Absolutely. And how fascinating how much you were influenced by that experience when you were an undergrad, and now you have opportunities to...
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's, that was such a blur to me, you know. I would totally do life in a different way, probably. But, yeah, it feels great now to be able to be that person for those students.
So you're still a very productive artist in your own right, who is not relying on your academic career to sort of dissuade you or deter you from your own personal goals.
Oh no, it's perfect. I must teach to make a living so that I can make what I want to make. Symbiosis, you know, one couldn't be without the other. Kind of, I don't get, you know, millions of dollars for each piece that I make, so I've got to keep my other job. But they're completely intertwined. And you know how you say, you know, if you're going to teach somebody how to do something, you have to even know it better yourself. So I think it really helps. You know, I show people that they can be creative, and I try to show them, you know, my steps along the way. And I think they can really start to wrap their brains around, well, this is maybe me in the future. Creating, making things. He's going through the same steps that I'm going through now with project number 3, you know. So, yeah, it's definitely intertwined.
Jesse, can you talk to me a little bit about what you hope to achieve with your art?
Two things. I've done one of them. Well, first of all, I always wanted to make people laugh with my work. What a great feeling. I mean, if you can make somebody laugh or smile.
With sculpture?
With sculpture and then laugh even?
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, you feel like you're on top of the world if you can get somebody to do that. And it's happened a few times. Oh, and I love it. It is just so nice to put a smile on somebody's face. I mean, it feels great to, you know, elicit that emotion. And my, what else I would like to do with my work, I really hope to make people, or at least someone, cry one day. You know, I think that is the next level of emotion. If I can make people laugh, that's great. But if I can make them cry, I think I'll die a happy man. No, but seriously, if I could continue what I like to achieve with my art, if I could continue doing what I'm doing right now, that would be it. Keep making art, showing art, teaching art. I would be very happy to just achieve that. And, you know, of course, every artist wants to reach an ever greater audience and show their work to more people and become more recognized. But if I can continue doing what I'm doing right now, you know, I'd be very happy.
But I want to talk a little bit more about how the situation in which people laughed. Was it in one of your more like installation pieces, or is it more of your standalone sculptures, or like do you notice that there is a different way that people receive those types of works?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of times when I've noticed it, it's within maybe particular pieces, but it's great that you brought that up, because one thing I've tried to do and with solo shows And what I plan to do in the future is bring all of these pieces together, and it's different. They're not objects or things anymore. They become this environment. Mm-hmm. And that's like kind of like an ultimate goal as well. Because once I can put human beings within this environment, I think they judge things in a different way. They become immersed, and they question less, and I think they accept more, because, you know, this is not their land anymore, and they're just within it, and they're just one of the beings, one of the other beings around the place. So I definitely something I've done a little bit, but I want to do more is create that whole installation where you're really part of an environment, if you will, where there's little things growing all around you and everywhere, off the floor and the ceiling and the walls, and you know, maybe you feel part of that. You know, maybe you could, I think we can feel a little bit more connected to them once they're all around us.
The relationship is so different between sort of like the static experience you have of looking at a piece of sculpture, or even walking around a piece of sculpture, compared to walking through a piece of sculpture or being surrounded by sculpture. You know, I think it in some ways takes us kind of outside of the Western art museum concept of how we're supposed to relate to art. You know, don't touch, don't get too close. You know, whereas when it's something, for example, like what you created in the Emerald Grove at Art Park, you know, that's something where you can touch and you can experience all these different nodes of it in different ways.
Yeah, and, you know, that's something where I make a lot of functional sculpture as well. Sometimes I hesitate to call it furniture, but sometimes I do. I guess I identify myself in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think that functional aspect, it's something people that find inviting. They can wrap their heads around something that is supposed to be touched, supposed to be pulled or opened. That's why Emerald Grove, that installation, was so much fun, because it was really meant for people to experience. So what, you know, what that is, it's probably covered about maybe like half an acre, a third of an acre at Art Park in the coolest little corner. I guess they used to call it a grove, the picnic grove. And it's just green everywhere, so I struggled with the name, but I ended up coming up with, you know, I wanted something kind of magical sounding, so I went with Emerald Grove. I was, after thinking about it for a month or a year or something. But anyway, it's like these 15-foot seed pods that are kind of like maybe in indigenous huts as well. You have little flowery spinner things on the top of them, and you can go inside of them. And you can run through them, and there's all these different bridges that you can run through. And I put little stepping stones to link all of the different elements together. And there's an earth mound there to kind of pay homage to the Indian mound that's, you know, a few hundred feet away in the woods. There's an old Indian mound there. One of the huts, I feel like a lot of people go there to concerts and they don't know that there's the Niagara River right there. They really don't. So I built this hut, and it had a little seat inside of it, and then it had a window, and you look through the window and you see the river. And I think as soon as I just finished that piece, 15, 16-year-old girl ran in there and said, "Hey, look, there's a lake over here." But, you know, that's starting the learning process I was talking about. it's also within this other piece there. There's a huge picnic table. The name of the artist eludes me right now. But it's huge. It's like 10 feet wide by 10 feet wide, and it's an entire pyramid placed down into the ground, which you can't see the top of it, and all the seats are pyramids, and I kind of appropriated it within my sculpture. And there's also these little sculptures that kids sit on and ride, if you will. They're abstract things, which is great again. One person thinks it's a giraffe, another person thinks it's a dinosaur, one person thinks this is a caterpillar, another person thinks it's a bean pod. And that's great at a kid's level because they are absolutely certain what it is. Grown-ups, they might not be sure or be uneasy around it, but kids, they know what it is. And it's sometimes I've you know, come there by chance to pick up some tickets or something, and there just happens to be 50 little kids and huge Art Park t-shirts running through it, and man, that feels great. It really does. Like, talk about making people laugh, yeah. You know, there you go, and it's so rewarding. Yeah. Oh, it feels so good. So I would, I plan to do more outdoor sculpture, interactive. I love that, just kind of fulfills another want of mine, if you will, to be a little selfish there.
You know, looking at examples of your work, both within collections and on your website, you work within a number of different mediums, but primarily working with wood. Could you talk a little bit about your experiences working with wood as a medium and maybe some other mediums you use as well?
Sure, I'd love to. Like I said before, I realized I've been working with wood literally my whole life. Ever since I was a kid, probably every day carving wood with knives and chopping it with axes and cutting it with machetes and breaking it. So I know those properties. I enjoy those properties. And wood's got so many great characteristics. It's flexible, but it's also hard. But it also seems soft and warm to the touch. It's inviting. It has a lot of dimension, even to a flat surface. Every single piece is unique because it's a living thing. It's living, it's breathing, it's sucking in moisture, it's letting out moisture, it's expanding, and it's always contracting. You look at it as a unique living being. And, you know, it feels good to work with, feels good to the touch. It sounds good when it clanks against itself, when it falls on the floor. It's got these great, great, great characteristics. I like the amount that it pushes back on my tool. If it was metal or stone, that pushes really hard. And you take off just a teeny little bit at a time. Clay doesn't hardly push at all, and you can go right into it. But I really like the amount of resistance I get from wood. I feel like it's a perfect amount where, you know, it's kind of in control, but I'm somewhat in control as well. I can work at it slowly and, you know, achieve what I want to achieve with it.
It's really interesting when you mentioned the living qualities of the wood, because that really put something into focus for me, where it's true, you know, metal and stone and glass even doesn't have that living quality in the same way that wood does. And given the biomorphic forms that you work in, there really seems to be something there. Can you talk a little bit about how you are able to transform wood into these really fluid forms where you're almost unaware of the solidity of the medium that you're working with? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about your process of creating such both fluid and active forms mm-hmm. in such a stable medium?
Sure. It really does make sense to me to be working with a living material if I'm attempting to create living things, if you will. you know, already having that inherent life really adds to the potential of the piece and the outcome. And the second part is, it's a real combination of things. I'm seeing the inherent energies inside of the potential piece, and I build up the piece to give myself the ability to create what I want to make, and then I reduce the piece. And a lot of times, the sculpture I'm working on will have multiple parts, and one will be a more solid, hard base. And then I'm thinking of a stretching or growing sort of quality to a stem or an arm. And then at the very ending point of that, you know, I see a tighter sort of spiral being created. So I think I actually not only look at the internal energies, but I think different parts are doing different things. And I'm trying to respond to what I think this piece is growing into. Yes, and some parts come out looking really hard. And some parts look like they're really stretchy. Some parts might look like they have very, very thin skin, and you can almost see underneath it. Yeah, some pieces are like encasing other pieces. And, you know, I focus a lot on connection points between two parts, a stem holding onto a fruit, and a base holding onto the earth and extending up. So I think I look at a lot of these individual parts differently and kind of judge their internal qualities and kind of see what they want to do and try to help achieve that.
It kind of makes me think of this quote that I'm going to butcher, that Michelangelo once said about how he created sculptures out of stone. He said that he was liberating the form from the block of stone.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you create works in a similar way or a different way than that?
Well, maybe somewhat, but it's a combination with me because it's like an additive process and then it's a reductive process. So probably not so much as liberating the form. Maybe after I build it up into a chunky piece that doesn't look right yet. Yeah, maybe then I feel like a little bit of liberation. But, you know, basically, I don't know, I'm thinking about what the piece wants to be and what it wants to grow into and, hell, what kind of emotion it has inside of it. You know, I'm making a little sad piece now, and I'm thinking about those qualities, and there's like positives in it and negatives in it, and there's a posture to it, but then there's also little uplifting positive little growing things growing towards the sun. So it's got all these different little energies going up and down, and different parts are doing different things. So some similarities, some differences.
Do you know what a piece is going to be before you start it?
I basically need to. And I kind of touched on that before, because it just requires a lot of planning with my material to draw it, do a full-scale drawing, maybe sculpt a little small form of it to understand what the form is going to look like. Because once I get into it, I feel it out a little bit, but I have to have a pretty good idea of what I want it to be, because it's tough to take a step backwards, and sometimes impossible.
Can you talk a little bit more about your functional sculptures and like what makes them functional?
Well, a lot of the pieces, there's not like a difference in the look. Everything I create with the same sort of mindset. But some of my functional pieces have, like, I call it hidden potential, maybe hidden storage, something that you don't know is there. I have a piece that these big buds on a wall with kind of sprouts coming out of them, and then I show people that they're drawers and there's storage behind all of them, And a lot of times when I describe that to people, show it to people, they're so relieved in a way, because they want there to be something inside of it. They know that it's got a lot of potential because it's just so damn big and juicy. And I feel like they want something to it. And when they see that, I think they feel fulfilled in a way sometimes, you know. And I think that's what I think about too. So I'm working on a piece now that is, it's got a belly on it, kind of a pregnant belly, and an arm that comes up and down. And I want to make it where you actually like grab the fruit and pull it, and that's what opens up the belly. You know, I maybe want to elicit this interaction even more. So I've got a plan for a piece. I'm working on that right now. That should be fun if I can pull it off.
So I want to ask you another question about your influences. And as you were talking about anthropomorphized animal forms,
mm-hmm.
your wife works largely in animal forms. And is there, what's the relationship between your two bodies of work and that sort of way? Do you find that just through conversations and seeing what she's working on, or maybe her seeing what you're working on, is there something there, or do you really try to keep that separate?
Well, definite influence. And we speak about, you know, our work usually one at a time,
yeah.
like either mine or hers, all the time. Yeah,
and we should say Jesse is married to Bethany Krull, who is a phenomenal ceramicist.
Amazing,
in Western New York.
Amazing ceramic sculptor. Well, that helps too. I mean, she pushes herself really hard. She does well at anything she wants to do. So, you know, when we talk about things, you know, we try to you know, elevate them, make them always better. Yeah, I'm sure there's an influence. I don't consciously. There's not, like, something absolutely direct. I think my work is, like, much more abstract than
very
hers.
Different, yes.
But she does make, like, perfect forms.
Yeah.
With perfect surfaces. And, you know, there's... We definitely influence one another. And she's the person I can talk to about what I'm trying to do, you know, on a very abstract level. And yeah, we help each other out all the time.
Awesome, thanks. I was just wondering about that. I wanted
yeah.
to touch on it. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the residencies that you've done in your trajectory building your art career. Can you talk a little bit about how you began exploring residencies
sure.
and where they've sort of fallen along your path?
Sure. Well, in graduate school, when I was getting close to finishing, probably a year before, it was time to start looking for residencies. And what my wife and I were looking for were year-long residencies. Because, you know, residencies can be anywhere from 1 week to 5 years. We were looking for something around a year. But we just started exploring online. There's, you know, artist databases that have different residency opportunities. There's residencies all over the country, all over the world, and they're just great positions, usually short-term, that you can go and immerse yourself in maybe another culture, another place, different kinds of people, other artists, new materials, and you can, undoubtedly, it's a new experience when you do that. So, yeah, what a great thing to do. We, like I said, my wife and I both got residencies at the Armory Art Center. And what a great thing to do after graduate school if you're still in kind of a learning stage of yourself and what you want to do. It's not like everyone is always going to get a teaching job at a college immediately after getting your MFA. No, I mean, absolutely not. So it's like, what's the next step after graduate school? And residencies are such a great thing to do. One of the armory, I cast bronze for the first time, learned the entire lost wax process, and what a great material. It was a chance for me. I developed a woodworking facility there, which they never had before. I established classes and a curriculum, and had students that were always my students while I was there. I got chances to work with all kinds of different age groups too, you know, from little teeny kids who they said, "Oh, it's time to go to stick class." They would call it stick class because we make little teeny huts. And actually, after we finished making our little teeny huts, we went out in front of the art center. And in Florida, there's nothing but palm fronds and branches and vines everywhere. So I gathered all these materials, and we made these huge structures, like in front of the art center. Oh, that was so much fun. I think the kids enjoyed it too. And after the armory, actually, we stayed there a couple of years. Like I said, met tons of artists, taught lots of different classes and lots of different capacities. Developed, you know, relationships that we're going to have forever. And that's an, you know, important thing to note. You know, start making connections with good people. And, you know, these connections will lead places if you want them to. After that, we went to Goggle Works in Reading, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. Another interesting experience. It was like the biggest community art center in the country. It was enormous. It was an old goggle factory. And we were resident artists there for a year. And I helped the wood shop out and created work. And we had a big, Bethany and I shared a studio on the third floor. Huge, beautiful studio. And we made work for a year and taught kids and taught older people and taught middle-aged people and young people and all kinds of people in all kinds of different capacities. And yeah, that was a really good experience. And, you know, I had teaching experience with lots of different age groups. And I started, you know, developing connections with collectors and galleries in all these different places, curators. You know, you want good connections with all of these people. I think residencies are a great thing for people to do after graduate school, to get their foot in all kinds of doors, to spread themselves around the country or the world, to get not only new perspectives, but to introduce themselves to other people.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, can you talk a little bit about what you've done personally to advance your career in the arts? And specifically, I'd like you to touch on maybe your development of your career as an exhibiting artist, and maybe
sure.
How you've set up exhibitions and what
right.
that's looked like.
Well, you know, right from the start, while I was creating work, even within, you know, grad school, I really had to take every single opportunity to show the work, whether it be, you know, final show of the department, or a graduate student show. Or, you know, I even did the Elmwood Art Festival one year. And I think you've just got to take every, I had to take every chance to try to get my work out there. Especially, you know, group shows and juried exhibitions are important, you know, because that, you know, validates your work. It's good enough to be amongst the others.
And of course, Jesse is a participant in our Art and Craft Media exhibition this year, which is a juried exhibition.
That's right. Yeah, so I think I've really had to take every opportunity to show the work. Like I said, you know, in West Palm Beach, where we went to residencies, we had a artist in residence show. That was our culminating solo show. But also showed at colleges down in Miami and, you know, like Palm Beach galleries. And you know, that was an important thing to do, to pretty much show every chance you get. Oh, I think my one of my early pieces in Rochester, I donated to an auction. And it's tough to make that thing you spent like many hours on and just pretty much give it away. But it's what I knew I had to do. You know, you've got to get your work out there. I mean, I don't make any of these things for myself. I don't want to keep any. I mean, I would love to, but I don't even think of it as a possibility to keep any of these pieces. Sure, I'd love to be surrounded by them, but I feel a better ownership when someone else loves it, takes it in, calls it their own. I still feel like it's my piece, you know, I own it, but that's the goal, is to get these pieces to people who love them, and therefore I can make new pieces, because I always want to create new pieces. So now, you got to get ready for rejection too. Many rejection letters have come my way, applying to different shows. But it's necessary, because you'll be accepted into a few shows, and from those couple shows, you'll meet some new people and sell a piece, and meet a new director of a museum, and later on they'll invite you back to do a show because they are impressed with your quality of work. So it's continually putting yourself out there, looking for residencies, looking for exhibition opportunities, group shows that fit your theme, and if you keep making enough work, then you have the possibility to submit proposals for solo shows, where you can really show off your work in different parts of the country or different parts of the world. And like I said, along the way, while you're doing these, you're establishing connections with good people who are curators and museum directors, and you can call them up later on. They'll call you up later on. They'll remember you if you're worth remembering, and ask you to be a part of something. And I find that things always work like that. Yeah. I've still got really great connections with all the art centers I've been to, and I always will have those connections. So a lot about who you know and who you came across in your life and what kind of impression you made on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true in so many avenues of life.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So now that you have settled, who knows for how long, here in Western New York, you and Bethany are fairly established here for who knows how long.
Probably forever.
We're hoping.
Hopefully.
We're hoping. You guys bring a really phenomenal dynamic to this region, and it's nice seeing that reaffirmation that there's so much in Western New York that does draw artists here and that does provide a network for them. And I think also family is a part of that for you guys, right?
But yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a great cultural community here that loves the arts. And, I want it to be super well connected. I don't want it to just be Buffalo art. I want, Buffalo and Art Park and Chautauqua and all those places to be called, Western New York, because we've got a really good art scene here.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that kind of gets to my next question, which are, what are some of your needs as an artist establishing and growing and building your career that the larger arts community can provide you with? What are some things that you are lacking right now that the community can provide you with?
Basically as an artist, there's always services and materials that we need. But if you look at the bigger picture of like art centers, the Birchfield Penny, Albright Knox, museums and galleries, art centers, it's great to be recognized by these places, kind of believed in. And in turn, it kind of, makes one's work more legitimate. And in the complete other way, we legitimize the art centers and the museums by, being good enough to show in them. So there's tons of connections. We need publications. We need business cards and this thing you're setting up here with these interviews for artists. I don't know exactly what it will be in the future, but I think it will be helpful to all, to young artists, think about what their careers are going to be, and who knows, hopefully it can be helpful.
outside of Western New York, what would help advance your artistic career? You know, what are the next things you are thinking of now that you have to start conceptualizing for where you're at in your career?
Well, after a solo show here in Buffalo, I hope to put together proposals for solo shows, at least across the country, send out those proposals. You know, I'll have enough pieces. But also, I've got on my radar a couple residencies. One of them is in, I think it's Taiwan. Another one is in Korea. And these were brought to my attention by an artist at Art Park who I volunteered with this summer. A couple residencies that he's done before. And he thought they would really be into some of the outdoor work that I make. And I really want to continue doing that outdoors interactive work. It's different. It's fun, and I can loosen up in a way that feels good. So I'm definitely planning on pursuing both, you know, national solo shows and some international residencies to go to new places, not only to travel, but to meet artists who have different perspectives, and constantly coming up with finding out about new opportunities. So those are a couple things I have on my radar right now.
So I think my last question for our interview today is, what advice do you have for emerging artists? Or another way we could ask that is, and I don't know if I should make this two questions, but another question that I sometimes like to ask if people don't want to answer that is, mm-hmm. What would you tell yourself when you were coming right out of school if you could now?
All right, that's kind of a less harsh way of asking it. What would I tell emerging artists, or what would I tell myself? I think it's important to do things well. That is broad, I know. But, you can't really stop if you're tired. You have to set lofty goals for yourself. And then you must follow through with those goals. I mean, as simple as that. I think myself when I was younger, to get in the place I am today, I tried to do those things, you know, without breaking it down into words, but I talked a good game, but then I, you know, fulfilled it. And I think that's one of the most important things to do, you know, set the bar really high but don't ever fall short of that bar, you know, and impress people, you know, try to do impressive stuff. Everyone's seen blah-blah stuff their whole lives, you know. Why not impress people?
Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with the professors in your MFA program at RIT and how they may or may not have influenced you, but also kind of touch on now that you're the shoe's on the other foot in some ways and you're the professor, your relationship with the students that you teach?
Yeah. That's a good question. You know, I was back in graduate school. My teachers, I don't know, they seemed to explain things like there was one way of doing things. And I learned a lot from them, but I also probably learned even more on my own. Trying the other ways to do things. So I feel like I kind of use them as a reverse barometer, if you will, and I don't do things like they did it. I do things completely the opposite. Yeah, I never had, I don't remember, like a great like art teacher as a mentor that I learned everything from and took me under their wing. I came about it in, I guess, more of an independent way. And I'm sure there are lots of reasons for that. I was probably kind of cocky in graduate school and kind of independent and wanting to do my own thing as well. But I now, as I teach my own students, I want to show them that there's lots of ways to skin a cat. If anybody says there's one way to do anything, they're wrong, because there's so many different perspectives. There's so many different minds thinking up ways to do things, and there's so many different possibilities that nothing that has been done has to be done again. And limits cannot be reached. I encourage my students to just try things, try it out. Don't be afraid to fail. Failure, I think, in graduate school, was like the biggest fear in the world, probably. I don't know. Well, I guess some people were okay with it, but I wasn't. I find that my students, especially in furniture classes where they're building things and making things, even though they might be students in other parts of the school, they don't do well, or they butt heads with another professor, they not social, or don't get good grades. I find a lot of times when they come to my shop and make a piece, everyone is working amazingly hard. No one complains. I mean, the minor complaints. Oh, my fingers hurt. Oh, I'm bleeding. Little things like that. But they love the thing that they're making. They find love for it early on. They've already dedicated hours and hours and days into it. They know what it should look like, what it could look like, and they keep working, and they don't settle for less. And it's just so unique that, other things they might not do their best in, but once something is theirs, their little baby, if you will, and they start, holding it and sanding it and caressing it, they start thinking of it as their own little offspring. I think they start treating it with, amazing care. And I just always get great results.
Yeah.
They always get great results because they're all into it. I love that.
Isn't that interesting, too? That's another way where you're helping to create these biomorphic relationships, right? Where you're, encouraging students to anthropomorphize their lamps or their furniture objects.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really incredible to hear about, because so many people's experiences of going through academia is so focused on these paper product outputs, right? Where you're just churning out these papers, and it becomes very formulaic, and it's something that, you understand the structure and then you just fill in the blanks. And myself personally, I went through experiences like that, and it gets to a point where you don't have time to care about what you're writing because you have so many deadlines and you have so many different projects. And so you say what you know they want to hear.
Yeah.
And you don't give yourself the time to really process
what you like it is fill in the blanks.
You fill in the blanks. It's like Mad Libs.
Yeah.
Grad school is like Mad Libs sometimes. Whereas what you are doing in this project is throwing all that out the window, and really saying, create something that you care about that's meaningful and that's tangible.
Mm-hmm.
After so many of the papers that we write, maybe even some of them go for publication or stuff like that, but the impact can be very limited. And also, I think because the language structures are very closed off to many people. Mm-hmm. Academia has its own privileged bars that
I know its own vocabulary.
Its own vocabulary that if you don't get it, then you don't. You're not.
You're
the
not
club.
Part of it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think as far as I'm concerned, it still kind of goes back to my parents and wanting to do things themselves, do things with their own hands, make their own things. And it's not an out-of-date practice. I have some students who it's obvious that they've never held a drill, loosened a bolt, anything in their lives before, because it just wasn't asked of them, and they didn't know that they might enjoy it if they sought it out. But yeah, creating things with your hands, what a great experience. It's something I'll do my whole life, and I think everyone can learn a lot from it, you know, just like being a part of physical matter, you know, and molding it. But I do also want to touch on, you were talking about writing. Another important thing for, you know, emerging artists is the writing part of it. You must always write an artist statement and be constantly revising your own thoughts to help to articulate those to others. You must, you know, always have a written biography. You must always have a well-done website. Everything, you know, must be quality. You must always have an updated resume. So there will always be a writing component.
Absolutely.
to all of this artistic, in this whole artistic career.
And I think that's necessary because in so many ways, you know, the relationship between the product and the conceptualization may not be straightforward.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Clear, you know, and how can you expect the viewer, the collector, the museum to really understand why you made what you made unless you can articulate your own thoughts in a cohesive manner?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times I believe that, you know, it should really come down to the piece.
Yeah.
But a new brilliance is seen in people's eyes when they learn a little bit more about why.
And that's something that I often challenge myself with or confront myself too, which is that I love reading artist statements. I love knowing the care that goes into the creation of a piece or also the art historical background of a certain piece, you know. And especially with modern and postmodern art, there's that, you know, cliche conversation of, oh, it's just a red panel, it's just a red painting, you know, and something like that. If you're not in the art club, you have a very different relationship with that piece than once you do have some understanding of the background of the piece, you know, and so things like that, I find that, yes, and yes, they do speak to people, you know, like Bruce Nauman's pieces speak to so many people, and to the point where they incite violence against it, you know, at points. But I do think that understanding the context of creation is an important part of understanding what's been created. In a similar way where, with you, you know, it seems like what really motivates you is the love of creating, the love of making. And even though you do love the pieces that you make and love what you're able to articulate, you're also able to let it go so well because you just want to make more. You know, you want to make new things, make different things.
Yeah, I am kind of, I love creating, and that might sound a little a little pompous, but
no.
It's a fun thing to make new things, especially new lives.
Jesse, is there anything else you'd like to say about your work or your career?
Oh, no, that's about it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to
Thank you, Heather.
Meet with us
I had
today.
A great time.